Under Rule 404B, evidence of other crimes, wrongs, or acts is not admissible to prove the character of a person in order to show that he acted in conformity therewith. It may, however, be admissible for other purposes. The North Carolina Supreme Court recently held the trial court, in a self-defense case, reversibly erred by excluding evidence of the victim's prior convictions offered by the defendant to show his state of mind. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Hague, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina.
So, Joe, we're starting with another self-defense case, but for a twist, this one is not about the defensive force statutes. So let's talk about State versus Hague.
State v. Hague. Yeah, there was an issue of the defensive force statutes at the Court of Appeals, but that kind of gets filtered out by the time this gets to the North Carolina Supreme Court. This was a case decided by the Supreme Court on May 22nd, 2026. It's a case from Iredell County. The facts were Thomas Cass, the victim, age 46, and his friends enjoyed hunting for doves in a cornfield in Iredell County. The defendant, age 71, lived nearby where he operated a horse rescue farm. Defendant and Cass apparently had had several prior interactions. Defendant knew that Cass was a felon, that he had hunted with a shotgun, and that Cass occasionally also carried a pistol. On September 7th, 2020, Cass and his friends were hunting in the cornfield when defendant approached. Defendant walked toward Cass. Cass raised his arms and pushed the defendant down. Defendant hit the ground and slid backward. According to defendant, Cass said, "I'm done," and reached for his vest pocket. Defendant then drew his own firearm, shot Cass once. Cass died as a result of that injury, and in September of 2020, defendant was indicted for murder. The matter came on for trial by jury in December of 2022. Defendant claimed self-defense. At trial, the trial court granted the state's motion in limine to exclude evidence of Cass's prior felony convictions. The trial court also agreed to redact portions of the defendant's 911 call that referred to Cass's prior convictions. On December 9th, 2022, defendant was convicted of murder. He was sentenced to life without parole, and he appealed. Upon review, the Court of Appeals over a dissent ruled that the trial court erred by denying the defendant's motion to dismiss the charge of first-degree murder, finding there was insufficient evidence of premeditation and deliberation, and by excluding evidence of Cass's prior felony conviction. The Court of Appeals ordered a new trial. The state appealed based on the dissent. The defendant also filed a petition for discretionary review on a jury instruction issue, which the North Carolina Supreme Court allowed. So basically, this case was before the Supreme Court based on requests from both parties. The North Carolina Supreme Court began with Evidence Rule 404B. That rule says that evidence of other crimes, wrongs, or acts is not admissible to prove character of a person to show action in conformity therewith, though it may be admissible for other purposes. In a footnote, the Supreme Court said, when the defendant's acts are subject to Rule 404B, that requires a showing of similarity and temporal proximity between the prior act and the crime charged. The Supreme Court said, but these requirements are not applicable when the evidence is offered to show the defendant's state of mind was reasonable in light of his knowledge of the victim. I think that's an important point that the Supreme Court makes in that single footnote here, and it's one that's picked up in the dissent. The North Carolina Supreme Court went on to say that evidence relevant to the defendant's state of mind at the time of the killing is not prohibited by Rule 404B, citing a case called Jacobs. When the defendant uses the prior acts of the victim to show his state of mind, he must show, however, that he was aware of the prior act. Here, in order for the jury fully to understand the defendant's state of mind, the Supreme Court said it was necessary for the jury to know what defendant knew about Cass's prior convictions. As the defendant offered the convictions to prove his state of mind and not to prove action in conformity therewith, the trial court erred by excluding the evidence under Rule 404B. Further, the Supreme Court went on to find that the redaction of the 911 call was prejudicial because it reduced the defendant's credibility and changed the jury's perception of his state of mind. This was a part where, in the course of talking to the 911 responder, defendant had referred to knowing that Cass was a felon, that he carried a firearm, that they were hunting in this field. The trial court allowed the state to redact that information and then stitch it back together. It produced the unfortunate result of making it look like the defendant was calling Cass, saying he was hunting illegally, when there was no indication that he was, in fact, hunting illegally, but for the fact that he was a felon in possession of a firearm. The North Carolina Supreme Court ultimately held that the trial court prejudicially erred by excluding evidence of Cass's prior felony convictions and that defendant was entitled to a new trial. As to the jury instruction issue, the Supreme Court found that discretionary review was improvidently allowed. The North Carolina Supreme Court also said that because the defendant will receive a new trial on the evidentiary issue, we need not reach the issue of the sufficiency of the evidence of premeditation and deliberation. There were a few other additional opinions here. There was a concurrence by Justice Berenger, joined by Justice Allen. Justice Berenger was concerned with the state's argument that there was sufficient evidence of premeditation and deliberation. She said the fact that the defendant had a pistol would evince premeditation and deliberation only if it indicated that defendant had anticipated a violent confrontation. Here, it did not. She said the routine preparedness to defend oneself is not evidence of premeditation and deliberation to support first-degree murder. That was the opinion only of two justices addressing that sufficiency of premeditation and deliberation. That does not represent the opinion of the entire court. And then there was a dissent from Justice Berger, who found issue with a lot of the different twists and turns that were taken by the majority in reaching this evidentiary ruling. According to Justice Berger, Rule 404A, that's the rule that allows a defendant to offer evidence of the victim's character in a self-defense case to show, for example, circumstantially that the victim was the aggressor in a confrontation. He said Rule 404A is the only proper avenue by which a defendant in a self-defense case may present evidence of the victim's character. He said further that Rule 405 governs the method of proof by reputation or opinion and specific instances. So according to Justice Berger, there was sort of a different legal analysis that should have governed the admissibility of this evidence of prior convictions. Justice Berger would have held that the trial court did not err in ruling that the defendant failed to satisfy Rule 404A and Rule 405, and that the admission of this evidence that was properly excluded.
So, Joe, that issue raised in the dissent is sort of what I'm trying to wrap my head around. You know, Justice Berger seems to be making the point in that dissent of this feels like we're throwing the door open to character assassination of the victim. You know, that we're going to talk about the fact that in his examples are, so your victim had a felony conviction for felony littering in excess of 500 pounds, you know, and that's something that's going to be put in front of the jury. I'm sort of trying to reconcile that with some of the discussion in the majority opinion where they seem to be saying here, it's not just that it was a felony conviction. It was that there was a felony conviction coupled with this possession of a firearm under these particular circumstances of being out in the field hunting. The part that caught my eye was where the majority says, this position is distinct from an argument that Mr. Haig generally feared Mr. Cass because of Mr. Cass's prior felony convictions. But they talk about how the prior conviction went to whether Mr. Haig acted reasonably in self-defense because he would have known that Mr. Cass was a felon and because he was using a firearm to hunt and was therefore committing a felony that day in the field. You know, and so this pattern, as they say, of just ignoring certain parts of the law. So can you help me wrap my head around that? I mean, to what extent is it tied to the particular facts and circumstances of the case versus to what extent it's potentially any felony, or is it both of those?
There's a good body of case law on this. It's something that I've written about before, the question of the use of character evidence in a self-defense case. So first of all, preliminarily, it has to be a situation where the defendant is alleging a justification for his use of defensive force. The second thing, and this goes to what you were talking about, Jonathan, the defendant's knowledge of the victim's character. This has to be items that the defendant knew about at the time that he used force. Because as the case law says, it's an older case called North Carolina Supreme Court case called Johnson. Basically, the defendant is permitted to put the jury in the defendant's position in order to prove the reasonableness of his fear, the reasonableness of his apprehension of the victim. So the jury should know everything that the defendant knew at that time. There are two sort of conditions on this kind of evidence. First, it has to be a case of legitimate self-defense where the defendant is claiming a justified use of force. And secondly, it has to be items that were within the defendant's knowledge at the time that he used that force, because only evidence that he knew about would go to the reasonableness of his apprehension of the victim. Now, there's another way that character evidence can come in, can be introduced by a defendant in a self-defense case, and that is to show circumstantially that the victim was the aggressor. But that is an entirely different kind of evidence presented for a different reason. That's not the kind of evidence that comes in here, where it's presented to show the defendant's state of mind, the basis of his apprehension of the victim.
So then for me to try to marry these two things together, I mean, if it were the alternate example the majority is talking about, I just ran into this person at the grocery store, and when he reached into his pocket, I'm claiming I thought he was reaching for a gun, he was going to try to kill me, and that's why I shot him in self-defense. And I want to offer evidence that part of the reason I thought that is because I know he has a felony conviction for littering in excess of 500 pounds. Am I reading this case right to say that the defendant would be allowed to put that evidence in front of the jury, and then it would just be on me as a prosecutor to argue to the jury why that's just kind of a ridiculous claim to be making?
I think that's right. I think the safer evidentiary ruling would be yes. If the defendant knew that about the victim, then he can present that evidence as a basis for his reasonable fear. Now, you get to the point you're talking about of there are certain felonies, there are certain character evidence that the defendant might put on as a basis for his apprehension that clearly are not going to stand the laugh test in front of the jury. If he says he's afraid of this guy because he knew he was stealing pine straw, that probably is not going to be a winning argument. But it doesn't go to the admissibility of the evidence. It goes to whether that's persuasive to the jury. If the defendant wants to put that on to show the supposed reasonableness of his apprehension, I think he has a right to do that. The other interesting question there is, what if he thinks the victim has a prior conviction that he doesn't in fact have? Or what if the defendant believes the victim has these other character attributes that maybe aren't borne out by other evidence? I think if the defendant wants to take the risk of getting up there and telling the jury, that's what I thought about this guy, he can say that. And then it becomes a question for the jury whether they're going to believe it was reasonable for the defendant to respond as he did on the basis of that belief.
You know, we said this was not about those defensive four statutes, but I feel like we're sort of landing at the same place we have when we talked about some of those other kind of cases of maybe just cautioning prosecutors that it can sometimes feel like a little bit of a gamble in terms of taking away an argument from the defense attorney. Maybe in some of these cases, it seems like it might be a safer call to just say, I'm going to take the cautious approach and let them put that in there and then just try to argue about why the jury should do the right thing with it.
Absolutely. And just from the point of view, you know, Jonathan, I was an appellate attorney for a long time. It's always better to have these claims rejected by a jury than by a judge, because when the judge rejects that claim, you've created an issue for the appeal. Whereas if it's one that's presented to the jury and the jury just doesn't buy it, that's typically not something that the defendant's going to be able to raise before the Court of Appeals. Well, the second case we had on for today was State v. Phillips.
Right. This is a case from the Court of Appeals from May 6th of 2026, a case out of Buncombe County. And this is a case generally dealing with two issues. We're talking a little bit about substitute expert testimony, kind of specifically tied to this question of photographs. And then a second issue dealing with this question of opening the door to some otherwise inadmissible evidence on vouching. But the factual background for the case is that the defendant and his wife met back in January of 2019. They got married in July of 2020. The evidence that came out at trial indicated that the defendant had introduced his wife to methamphetamine back in 2019. Both had stopped using it by 2020, but then sometime around May of 2023, the defendant started using it again, and that led to a number of difficulties they were having in terms of his odd and assaultive behavior, some kind of paranoid activities or paranoid thoughts that he was having, and a number of incidents occurred during 2 weeks leading up to their son's first birthday, which was going to be on July 17th of 2023. On that morning, the defendant was out back. He was smoking methamphetamine, came back inside the house, making some wild claims about seeing people outside that he believed were people that the victim was having an affair with and so on. He became very angry and starts beating her with a cane, ultimately breaks the cane and then tries to stab her with it. And this assault sort of escalates and gets worse to the point where he's eventually strangling her, saying that he's going to kill her, grabbing her by the neck a number of times, biting her. Finally, it breaks up when the son of the couple woke up and the defendant told the victim, Pearl, to go and get him. After she had done that, the defendant, in sort of his twisted thinking, tells her that she is going to call 911, but he's going to tell her what to say to sort of try to convince them that there are no issues or concerns in the house, makes her put on long sleeve clothing, for example, so they won't be able to see any of the injuries that she suffered. So law enforcement does come out to the house that first time, but they don't see anything of concern, so they leave. But a few hours later, the victim, Pearl, convinced the defendant to let her call 911 again, and he allowed that, but only after she had showered the blood off. When the deputies come back out to the house a second time, now they learn that there's a child in the house, so they get DSS involved. And once learning that her son was safely in the custody of DSS, the victim, Pearl, can then finally feels comfortable enough to tell the first responders what's really going on about all the incidents that have happened with the defendant. So when she gets taken to the hospital, she's given some treatment, some examinations, and specifically she's examined by a sexual assault nurse examiner by the name of Smith, who took upwards, they say, of 140 different photographs of her injuries. So this sort of sets up issue number one that we're going to be talking about. The defendant is ultimately charged with felony assault by strangulation, assault on a female, assault with a deadly weapon, communicating threats, first-degree kidnapping, and assault inflicting serious bodily injury. But at the time those cases, all those charges came on for trial, the nurse who did the examination, Smith, had moved to Florida, was not available to testify, and so the state called her supervisor, also a sane nurse named Mallett, to testify regarding Pearl's injuries, and that nurse was qualified as an expert and testified that she had reviewed the prior sane nurse's examination report, and looking at other photographs and documentation, had reached her own conclusions about those injuries that the victim suffered. The defense objected to that, but the trial court overruled it and allowed Nurse Mallett to give that expert opinion. And so she said that based on her independent review of the photographs, the charts, and the statements from the victim, she concluded there was evidence of manual strangulation and that the injuries were consistent with her statements about being physically punched and kicked, strangled, and even beaten with a cane. The second issue that comes up is also dealing with some of the testimony in the case, this time from the law enforcement, from a detective named Burns. After Pearl, the victim, had testified at trial about using methamphetamine in the past, potentially even using it on June 23rd when she had an overdose, the detective explained that during an interview he had conducted with the victim, she had entirely denied using methamphetamine, said that she had never used it. So then this, of course, came up on cross-examination when the defense counsel was asking the detective whether, you know, based on now having seen her on the stand admit to using meth and yet having given an interview to you where she denied ever using it, defense attorney asked the detective if he had any concerns about her truthfulness. And the detective replied, "I believe she just told me the one lie, to my knowledge, concerning the charges. I don't have any concerns about her truthfulness." This then gets sort of dug back into on redirect examination and then again on recross examination, asking about whether the detective found her to be believable, found her to be credible. Ultimately, in fact, on recross examination, the defense attorney asking the detective, "How could he believe Pearl 100% if she has shown she is willing to lie to you about her methamphetamine use?" Joe, this is not the point of the case, but I would just sort of offer this as a maybe a takeaway for prosecutors, the trial tip of cross-examination. You know, I think the detective, to his credit, takes that open-ended question on cross-examination and runs with it, you know, of saying, "I will tell you exactly why I find her to be 100% truthful about the assault, despite this other lie." Talks about, you know, this is a mother. A mother will do anything they can to protect their child and, you know, even lying to the police and so on. So then that sets up what the defense is arguing here on appeal, saying that it was plain error for the trial court to have allowed that vouching testimony to come in. So as to those two issues, looking back at that issue number one, what we're talking about is what the defense says is a confrontation clause issue. You know, that we allowed this essentially a substitute expert witness to come into court and say, "I have looked at the investigation, the reports and everything else, all the materials collected by the earlier expert who is not here, and now I'm going to come in court and give you my opinion about it." And so it raises the question of whether that's a confrontation clause or Crawford v. Washington violation. They sort of review the basic law that I know all the prosecutors know to implicate the confrontation clause. They say a statement must meet two criteria, namely the statement must be hearsay for the truth, and two, it must be testimonial. And they are citing to State v. Clark, for example, as a post-Smith v. Arizona case of ours, establishing that. Of course, Clark is, as we record this episode, on appeal to the North Carolina Supreme Court right now. But they review the Smith v. Arizona case from the U.S. Supreme Court, which established that if there's an out-of-court statement offered in support of the testifying expert's opinion, and the statement supports that opinion only if true, then the statement has been offered for the truth of what it asserts, and therefore it would be hearsay. Joe, as you and I have talked about at a number of trainings for prosecutors, that's really only sort of one half of the question. You know, the other half of the question is, all right, even if it is hearsay, Rule 703 would allow an expert to offer otherwise inadmissible testimony. Is it also testimonial hearsay? And if so, then it would be a confrontation clause violation. And so the court explains kind of that there's that second prong to it. So for guidance on how to resolve that in this case, they look to a prior case called State versus Ball, which they note had strikingly similar facts. So similar, in fact, that it is the same witness. It is, in fact, that same Nurse Mallett who similarly was asked to come in and testify for a different sane that had done the examination but was no longer available at trial. And in State v. Ball, they found that there was no plain error in admitting the sane exam report prepared by this other nurse, but then allowing Nurse Mallett to provide surrogate testimony for Nurse Sullivan.
Well, hold on a second. State v. Ball precedes Smith v. Arizona. And as I recall, Ball relied on that Rule 703 rationale of, "We're not relying on this for the truth of the matter because it's an expert the basis of expert opinion. How is the Court of Appeals now going to reach back before Smith v. Arizona and rely on a prior case to uphold the admission of this testimony?
Joe, I think you're exactly right. You know, we were sort of living in a weird world ever since Williams v. Illinois, where they said, we're not really buying this whole, it's not hearsay because it's only offered as the basis of my opinion. We know that's the part Smith v. Arizona rejected. You know, they said, even if it is basis of your opinion under 703, it would still be hearsay if you have to rely on it for the truth of the matter asserted. So they find that to be useful guidance. But we also are in sort of a weird situation here because we don't have the entirety of what may or may not have been relied on by this Nurse Mallett, right? We know that Nurse Mallett, for example, was looking at the photographs, but they say in the opinion, crucially, however, neither Nurse Smith's report nor Nurse Mallett's written opinion based on Nurse Smith's report and photos are contained in the record on appeal. We are therefore unable to discern which portions, if any, of Nurse Smith's statements formed the basis of Nurse Mallett's conclusions. And so kind of what they're getting at is, we know she relied on these photographs, these 140-some photographs that the earlier saying took of the victim's injuries. And based on the photographs, plus things like the victim's statements and so forth, that's the opinion, arguably, or as far as we know, that's the opinion that the expert is actually giving in this case. And that's how they kind of resolve this Smith v. Arizona Confrontation Clause issue, is they're saying, all right, if all we know for sure is that she was relying on things from the prior expert, such as the photographs, we don't see a Confrontation Clause issue with those photographs. And the reason for that is because, as they say, the photographs are, those are data, right? That it's output of an instrument or a device. It's not a statement from a person. And so there's no way that that information or that material could be hearsay at all. As in Ball, if Nurse Mallett could determine here by looking at the photographs taken during the examination that Pearl had been strangled, then Nurse Mallett provided her own independent opinion of the images taken during the victim's examination. Now, what gets interesting is we could stop there, but the opinion sort of goes on and says, our holding is distinguishable from the line of cases that have found the Confrontation Clause to be violated, where a testifying expert must rely on the truth of an absent expert's statements to reach his or her conclusions. And then this later part, in the context of drug analysis or DNA testing, for example, the accuracy of the results testified to depends on the fact that the absent analyst performed the test correctly, and whether that fact is true depends on whether the absent expert properly applied her specialized skill and training. In other words, they're drawing a line here between something like photographs, where they say there's no statement, there's no expertise or anything like that involved. The photograph is what it is. Somebody just pushed the button and here it is. Whereas in their view, something like drug analysis or DNA, you're relying on the statements of an intermediary to say, I prepared the sample correctly, for example, or I, you know, didn't leave it exposed to the sun where it could have degraded or anything like that. And so they, in their view, it works here, but they would not expect it to work anywhere else. You know, compared to, in their words, a photograph, which speaks for itself, and thus its accuracy does not depend on the truth of any factual assertions.
John, I don't know about you. I find this a little frustrating because you get down to the bottom of the opinion and then they're addressing this as though the objection was to the photographs and not to the report, which they say we can't tell whether the report of this nurse or that nurse was not included in the record. What is the hearsay statement that is alleged to have been admitted in error? Could you tell?
So, I mean, I think what we're going to get to, I think in some future cases that have already come out prior to us recording this episode, I think the statements they're talking about are things like statements from the earlier analyst saying that, for example, a sample was prepared correctly, you know, or that the test was administered in the right way. I also struggle with it because it's very difficult for me to see a genuine difference that they're trying to draw here between the output of a camera versus the output of a gas chromatograph. I understand in their view, we're relying on statements of the other analyst to say, I prepared the slide correctly to put in the chromatograph or
but
the instrument.
But you could say the same thing about a photographer, right?
Right.
I mean, how did you pose the picture? Where were the people standing? Where were the shadows or something like that?
What f-stop were you using? Or, you know, these people look like they're the same height. Are they standing on the same level or is somebody on a box? I mean, you know, you could kind of, it feels like a little bit of an artificial distinction to say one is pure no statement output, whereas the other is output that depends upon the truthfulness of statements. It's a little bit of a difficult distinction to draw, but nevertheless, that's how they're ultimately resolving it here. And then further finding that, you know, even if there would be no prejudice, even if there were error in allowing the photographs, given, you know, the other overwhelming evidence of guilt. Very briefly, that second issue that we talked about, this question of vouching. They sort of reiterate the law that, you know, the defendant did not object to the testimony at the time, so we're just looking at this for plain error on appellate review, but they find that we do not have that here. Yes, under Rule 701, it is improper for one witness to vouch for the veracity of another. We don't put you up there to say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I think you should believe witness Holbrook when he testifies. But that is sort of offset in this case by this opening the door concept. You know, it was the defense attorney who threw open the door by questioning the detective about whether or not he believed the victim in the case. And so in their view, then, it is entirely reasonable for the state to come back and say, your belief in her testimony was put in issue and questions were asked about it. So I'm going to follow up now on redirect. Well, why do you believe this is true? And then, you know, sort of goes even farther on that recross. And then the detective gives his answers explaining exactly why. And they feel like that those responses from the witness in this case were appropriate. The defendant opened the door for the detective to then comment on the witness's credibility. So they agree with the state's view on it.
I guess the takeaway for prosecutors is just be careful listening for the kind of questions that are asked on cross-examination. I don't read this as a broad license to put on that kind of, you believe everything the victim said, merely because the defense counsel has questioned the credibility of the victim. Is that right, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that here it really was sort of limited to this, especially then, you know, Joe, there was the original question of from the defense attorney on cross about why would you believe that, or and then the recross of, but how can you believe this is true in light of the other fact? I mean, it really is sort of throwing the door open for the state or for the witness to then say, allow me to answer that question. Let me go into some greater detail explaining to you why I find that believable. And that was sort of the halfway joking comment I was making earlier in the case, saying that that's maybe a takeaway for prosecutors is when we're on the flip side of this, we don't ask the witness, but how can you believe that, right? We just throw out those closed questions. You're telling us you believe her 100%. You're also telling us, you know, she lied to you on a prior occasion. Thank you. You know, I mean, we just kind of cut it there. But here, given that it was thrown open for that follow-up testimony, it was proper for the state to do so.
The third case we had on for today was State v. Palmitter. This was a case decided by the Court of Appeals on May 6, 2026. It was a case out of Mecklenburg County. The facts of this case, Diana and her four-year-old daughter, Mary, moved to the United States in 2015, and Diana and the defendant were married. The evidence showed that the defendant sponsored Mary's immigration, referred to Mary as his daughter, was listed as her father on school enrollment forms. There was other evidence that the defendant provided Mary's health insurance, her food, and other necessities. On November 22, 2022, Diana told defendant that he should go visit his brother in Michigan for Thanksgiving, and the defendant went on this trip. Mary was last seen at school on November 21, 2022, and has not been seen since. In November and December, a school counselor attempted to reach to the defendant about Mary's absence. The counselor attempted to conduct a home visit in December, but nobody responded to her knock on the door. Diana apparently called the counselor back at some point, agreed to meet at the school. The counselor told her to show up with Mary, but Mary was not at that meeting. Diana and defendant arrived separately. Diana told the counselor that Mary was missing. The counselor at that point contacted Department of Social Services to report the disappearance. The defendant, in an interview with police, said that he saw Mary prior to his trip to Michigan. He acknowledged receipt of the school counselor's messages, but thought that Diana was handling it. Diana had told him, he said, that she did not know where Mary was. On December 17th of 2022, defendant and Diana were arrested for felony failure to report the disappearance of a child. Diana pled guilty, and the defendant pled not guilty. The matter came on for trial in May of 2024. Defendant testified in his own defense that he had no reason to think that Mary was missing because Diana had told him she was at home. Defendant sought to introduce text messages that Diana had sent to a cousin, signed Diana and Mary, indicating again that Mary was with her mother. Defendant argued that evidence corroborated his testimony, but the trial court excluded that evidence as hearsay and also irrelevant. Defendant was convicted in May of 2024, judgment was entered, and the defendant appealed to the Court of Appeals. Defendant raised four issues, the first being under General Statute 14-318.5, making it a crime for a person to fail to report the disappearance of a child is unconstitutionally vague. He argued that the statute compels self-incrimination. He argued that the evidence in his case was insufficient. And finally, that the trial court erred by excluding that evidence of the text messages. I will just take a minute to say here, this statute 14-318.5, this is the first reported case in the appellate division of a prosecution under that statute, which was enacted in 2013. It's called Cayley's Law. The statute was a response to the death of Cayley Anthony, a toddler of 2 years old in Orlando, Florida, back in 2008, where the mother had reported her missing 31 days later. The mother was eventually tried for murder but acquitted. That provoked a national outrage, and about 10 states have passed these kind of Cayley's laws to criminalize the failure to report the disappearance of a child. Under North Carolina General Statute 14-318.5, a person providing care to or supervision of a child who knowingly or wantonly fails to report the disappearance of the child to law enforcement is guilty of a felony. Under the definition section, a child means a person under 16 years of age, and disappearance of a child is defined as when a parent or supervisor does not know the location of the child and has not had contact for a 24-hour period. Under 14.318.5G, any person who reports the disappearance as required is immune from civil or criminal liability, provided that the person was acting in good faith. Under that first issue, defendant initially argued that the statute was unconstitutionally vague. The state made an argument that the defendant failed to preserve that issue, but the Court of Appeals disagreed, finding that the argument the defendant made at trial was sufficient to preserve this vagueness challenge. Defendant basically argued that a literal interpretation of this statute would produce absurd results. The Court of Appeals noted that the void for vagueness doctrine requires a statute to define an offense with sufficient definiteness so that people can understand what conduct is prohibited and in a way that does not encourage arbitrary enforcement. It cited a U.S. Supreme Court case from 2010 called Holder in support of the proposition that a person who engages in some conduct that is clearly proscribed cannot complain of the vagueness of the law as applied to the conduct of others. In other words, a defendant who's raising these mere possibilities at what it says at the margins of the statute, it is potentially applicable to these absurd scenarios, is not going to succeed in showing that the core conduct prohibited by the statute is unconstitutionally vague. Here, the Court of Appeals said General Statute 14-318.5 has defined terms that apply without question to a core range of conduct. Defendant's conduct, it said, is clearly proscribed by General Statute 14-318.5, and application of this statute to this defendant's conduct is not absurd. As a result, the Court of Appeals concluded that the statute is not vague as applied to defendant and that his vagueness challenge fails. The defendant also argued that the statute violated the constitutional protection against self-incrimination. Under the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, no person shall be compelled in a criminal case to be a witness against himself. To qualify for that Fifth Amendment privilege, the communication must be testimonial, incriminating, and compelled. The Fifth Amendment privilege may not be invoked to resist compliance with a regulatory regime constructed to affect the state's public purposes unrelated to the enforcement of criminal laws. That's a U.S. Supreme Court case called Buchnight. Here, the Court of Appeals said, defendant may not invoke his privilege against self-incrimination to avoid compliance with this statute because it falls into the category of such broadly applicable and neutral statutory regimes. The Court of Appeals noted that the sort of disclosure compelled by this statute could aid in a prosecution, but the possibility of self-incrimination is outweighed by the broad nature of the statute and the strong policies in favor of disclosure. It applies to all parents or supervisors of children, doesn't target inherently criminal activity. The Court of Appeals analogized to that U.S. Supreme Court case Buchnight, where the United States Supreme Court held that a mother could not invoke the privilege against self-incrimination to resist a trial court's order that she produce her child in court, so ultimately found that the statute was not void for violating the defendant's constitutional protection against self-incrimination. There were two other sort of trial issues involved here. The defendant argued that there was insufficient evidence he violated the statute. He contended the evidence showed that he merely relied upon Diana's statements that Mary was at home with her while he was frequently away from the home at work. The Court of Appeals said a conviction for failure to report the disappearance of a child requires the state to show that the defendant knowingly or wantonly failed to report the disappearance. It said knowledge is a mental state generally proved by circumstantial evidence, including the conduct of the defendant, statements of the defendant, and others. Conduct is wanton when in conscious and intentional disregard to the rights and safety of others. Here, the state presented substantial evidence that the defendant knew Mary had disappeared and failed to report it. It's true, the Court of Appeals said, the defendant presented evidence that Diana told him that Mary was safe, but the jury was not required to believe that defendant was in fact persuaded by that representation. In the end of the day, the Court of Appeals concluded that the state presented sufficient evidence and the trial court did not err in denying the defendant's motion to dismiss. There was finally that last issue about the admissibility of text messages. Defendant argued the trial court erred by excluding the text messages that the Diana sent to her cousin, offered to corroborate his testimony. The Court of Appeals declined to address whether that was error, finding that the defendant failed to show prejudice in any event because other evidence showed that Diana had said Mary was with her, including a text message that Diana had sent to defendant himself. So in light of the existing evidence, Diana's text messages to her cousin would not likely have made a difference in the outcome. So ultimately, the Court of Appeals found no error in the defendant's conviction under this this relatively new statute for failure to report the disappearance of a child.
Yeah, I guess there's no way to know how often we might actually see this one coming up in practice, but to be the first one that we got, it's a fairly comprehensive review of what we would expect to be the most common arguments about the constitutionality of it, the self-incrimination, sufficiency of the evidence. It's helpful to have.
Right, absolutely. If this comes up again, you're going to see defendants raising these constitutional challenges, and we at least have this case saying that this has the statute has survived a constitutionality review, at least under these particular circumstances. That's all for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. Haig, holding the trial court erred by excluding evidence of the victim's prior convictions to show the defendant's state of mind. State v. Phillips, finding no confrontation clause violation and allowing a substitute analyst to testify to independent conclusions based on photographs. And State v. Perlmutter, upholding the constitutionality of the statutory offense of failure to report the disappearance of a child. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We're coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in Chapel Hill. Our producer is Paul Bonner. Our graphic designer is Emily Hinkle. Our applications manager is Chance Fitzgerald. Our music was composed by Gustav Holtz, who, incidentally, was a vegetarian. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, concerns, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks. Hope it helped.